All right. All right, can you hear me in the Zendo? All right, cool. Yes, hello everyone. I was previously in the Zendo this morning, but then I kept on getting these coughing fits, and I thought I should probably just go home and give the talk from there. I did come home and do a quick COVID test, and I'm fine. Probably would have been fine, but nobody really wants to be in a room with somebody who's coughing uncontrollably. So here I am back in my Zoom studio. All right, I will go around and say hi to the people on Zoom, and then those in the Zendo can say, well, yeah. I'll say their names and we'll repeat them, or hopefully we'll be able to hear you. I will start with John, Andy,
Andy.
Bob, Brian, Patricia, I mean
Patricia.
Pat, just reading your name, Ellen, Etsido,
That's dope.
Mark, Bill,
Bill.
Amelia, Paulette, Jinryu, Betty, Shoketsu, Camille, Jeannie, Chris, Lisa, Dennis, Tyler, Dave, Coral, Yeshe
Tsoki,
Sabrina,
Sabrina,
Ruth Ann,
Ruthann,
and those in the Zendo,
Jim,
Jim,
Katie,
Katie,
Linda,
Linda,
Ted,
Ted.
All right. So, in terms of announcements, I am going to go ahead and mute the Zendo at this point. You can unmute yourself when necessary. All right. So, as noted in the weekly email newsletter, most of our year's calendar has been plotted out. We are going to have a one-day retreat most months. Sometimes that's a term student retreat. We'll have a term student program in the spring, and starting February 26th and going through May 14th. There's more information. There will be more information in the newsletter. That's a program that you sign up for to create vows for a few months, and you attend the opening retreat and the closing retreat at the very least, and then you kind of form a cohort of people who are going through this at the same time. And we do have a one-day retreat on Saturday, January 29th, and you can participate in that in person or online, part-time or full-time. Brian, did you have a question or did I answer it? Let's see. Anything else? Can anybody, any questions or anything else that I should mention? All right. Okay. So today, as I was thinking about what I should talk about, I remembered that there were two questions left over from when I collected questions in December to just do kind of a Q&A talk. And so I figured I'd answer one of them today and address another one another week. So one question was, can I say something about formal vows and, what the little, things that we wear around our necks mean and some people have Dharma names and various things like that. Like, how, what's all that about? So I'm going to be talking about that today, formal Buddhist vows in our Soto Zen lineage. And the other question, which I will get to at some point, is pain in Zazen. So I figured I could do a talk on various challenges in Zazen, because that's very important as well. So today, vows in our lineage. I'm going to talk about what kind of formal vows we are, you have the option of taking, and why we take them. And I want to say from the outset that there's no need for you to do any of this that I'm talking about today. There's no expectation that anyone who participates needs to take any of these steps or take any of these formal vows that I'm talking about. It's entirely voluntary. This is a practice tool. So this is, you know, just, we have Zazen, we have Dharma study, we have chanting. You can come to the chanting on Sunday mornings if you want, or just come for Zazen, or you can, you know, just come for chanting and skip the Zazen, or like, there's various aspects of our practice which you are, you know, we use the Dharma Rain model of sharing the Dharma. So where I studied, the Zen Center is called Dharma Rain, and it takes its name from the Lotus Sutra, which has a parable in there about how the Dharma rains down on all beings, like the rain in a forest, and it's falling on trees and shrubs and little flowers, and every plant just takes what it needs. So that's the model that we have. We just share it freely. Nothing is held back, and you can take and use what you need. So vows are also a practice and should never be used merely as a way to claim power or status. So having taken vows should never mean one person's practice is valued above that of another's. And hopefully no one in our Sangha will ever feel excluded or lesser or pressured to take the kinds of vows that I'm going to talk about today. But at the same time, there's no denying that vows can, in a sense, kind of bring you closer to the center, get you more involved, more intimately involved. And, you know, it can seem kind of special. You're in the know, and you've got the little thing you wear around your neck, you've got a name, or you've got a... So it's kind of inevitable that these kinds of things can evoke a certain sense of obligation or pressure or comparison or something like that. And I don't think there's any way around that. And in our lineage, we've just decided, well, the pros outweigh the cons in terms of including these forms in our practice. So with that caveat, I'm going to talk primarily today about lay vows as we do them at Bright Way Zen. But I want to give some context first in terms of the tradition of vows in Buddhism. So most generically, vow is a way to shape our life. And I have a podcast episode on this, 124, the Buddhist practice of vow giving shape to our lives. So it's, as we all know, changing our behavior, our mind, our lives through sheer force of will can be very, very tricky. We may have intentions and they just don't come true. It's, you know, how do we make change? So vow is a way, is a one way to approach change, where we make a kind of commitment to ourselves or to others or in public, and then we live our lives in the context of that vow. And it's so we live in relationship to it. it's not that once we make the vow, now from here on out, it's perfect and we never make any mistakes. We perfectly keep that vow in every way. That's it'd be kind of nice, I guess. I vow I will never get angry again. All right. But if we have a vow, like we do in our precepts, to not indulge anger, we live in that context. It's to have stated an aspiration to not indulge anger. It feels different when we do get angry, and we get angry, side by side with our aspiration to not be controlled by it. So I just wanted to share with you a story. This is from a Dogen fascicle called The Power of the Robe. And he's talking about the monk's robe, the monk's okesa, which I'm going to show you some pictures of. So you might have seen either Theravadan monks, in their orange robes, or when I'm in the Zendo, I wear a, something over my shoulder. And those, all of our garments of various kinds are symbols of having taken certain vows. So this is closely tied, the robe and the vow are closely tied. So this is from Dogen's essay. He's repeating a story that comes from an older sutra, the Sutra on the Former Birth of the Nun Utpalavarna. So it says, at the time when the Buddha was in this world, Nun Utpalavarna attained 6 miraculous powers and became an arhat, a fully awakened being. She visited noble householders and talked about the life of home leavers. She encouraged noble women to become nuns. The women said, "We are young and beautiful. It would be hard to keep the precepts." Utpalavarna said, "It's all right to break the precepts. Just leave the household first." The women said, "If we break the precepts, we will fall into hell. How can we do that?" Utpalavarna said, "Then go ahead and fall into hell." They laughed and said, "We will be punished in hell. How can we fall into hell?" Utpalavarna said, "Reflecting on my former life, I was an entertainer, putting on various costumes and speaking memorized lines. Once I put on a nun's clothes for a joke. As a result of this action, I was reborn as a nun at the time of Kashyapa Buddha. Because of my high status and proper conduct, I grew arrogant and broke a precept. I fell into hell and experienced various punishments. In my next birth, I met Shakyamuni Buddha, left the household, attained 6 miraculous powers, and became an arhat. From this, I know that if you leave the household and receive precepts, even if you break a precept, you can become an arhat because of the merit of the precepts you have received. But you cannot attain the way if you only create unwholesome deeds without receiving the precepts. I was once a criminal falling in and out of hell. If a mere criminal dies and enters hell, there is nothing to attain. So you should know that even if you break a precept, you can attain the fruit of the way." So, of course, the precepts, these are the central vows in Buddhism. So when we formally become a Buddhist, we receive the Bodhisattva precepts, which are the moral guidelines for living our life. There's a great book that we have studied before by Shohaku Okumura called Living by Vow. It's a very, very sweet book about all of this kind of thing. And I love these couple quotes from him. He says, "A life led by vow is a life animated and inspired by vow. Not one that is watched, scolded, or consoled by vow. These verbs create a separation between the person and the vow. The simple phrase living by vow emphasizes that the person and the vow are one. Our life is itself a vow." So I like to talk about if you make a vow, if you take the precepts and then you break a precept, or you make personal vows like we do in term student. Maybe you want to work on a certain precept, or you want to study something, or you want to sit zazen more, or something like that. If you break them, I recommend you keep the vow around. You try to keep the vow, but if you aren't really keeping the vow very well, you still keep it around. Because now, when we decide to make vows, so I'm not going to talk a lot about this, but in my podcast I do, and there's an art to making a vow, to discerning what kind of vow to make, to discerning, is this the right time? Is this the right form? Is this too ambitious? Is this too easy? But once we have discerned a vow and we say, yes, this is what I want to, how I want to shape my life, the direction I want to go, then that reflects an important part of us. Now, there's another part that may, you know, indulge anger, or, you know, be lazy and skip zazen or whatever. But we want to keep both of these parts around. So even if we're not perfect, we want to honor that part of ourselves that has that aspiration. So just practically speaking, since the beginning of Buddhism, the main vows have been monastic ordination or home leaving. So this is around the time of the Buddha, and the monks and the Theravadan Buddhist monks, the ones in the orange robes, keep the form of that original Buddhism most closely of any extant Buddhist tradition, and they live by about 250 rules. So we live by, you know, 16 bodhisattva precepts. They live by 250 rules that, you know, dictate all aspects of their life. So talk about vow giving shape to your life. Their entire life is shaped by these vows. And we honor and support people who live by vow like that. Even if we're not about to do that, or we don't even want to do that, or whatever, there's something worthy of respect, in particular because the vows that they live by benefit us and the Sangha as a whole. So one of the things that ends up being connected with vows are these robes and various garments that we wear. So I'm going to share my screen and show you what we assume the original monk's robes look like. These are the Theravadan monk's robes. And the story of this is that, you know, originally, you know, the Buddha just was a guy, and he had folks who were practicing with him. But people wanted to support the Buddha and his disciples and give them donations and pay them respect. But there was a story of a rich man, and he was up on his elephant, and he saw these people coming, and he thought they were Buddha and his monks. So he got down, and like, which is something that ordinarily he would not do, is something, you know, great sign of respect. But then when they came closer, he realized they weren't the Buddha and his monks. So he asked the Buddha to please, will you please wear something that will tell me that these are Buddhist monks? So the Buddha's like, okay, fine. And they created a robe, which if you were to stretch out the Theravadan monk's robe, or my kesa, which I'll show you a picture of, it's made of pieces of cloth. So it's made of rows and squares that are lined up in rows. So the model, according to the story, is that the Buddha and Ananda looked out over the rice fields and thought that would be a good, you know, pattern for a robe. And also then you could make those robes out of pieces of discarded cloth. You didn't have to, you know, have the wealth to buy a big piece of material. You could just use discarded pieces and sew them together. So I will show you the, so as many of you are probably familiar, there is a Theravadan monk in a full robe. So that is, they have some undergarments on, but then, you know, pretty much like that is their whole garment. And then let's see. So there were also lay vows from the beginning, lay people who wanted to do the practice. And so they would take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And there were five precepts. So basically the first five of our grave Bodhisattva precepts: do not kill, do not steal, do not misuse sexuality, do not lie, and do not misuse intoxicants. Or originally it was do not sell intoxicants. So those were the five. If you were a lay Buddhist, you would vow to live according to. And I'm not sure that they didn't have like extra garments, but oftentimes in Theravadan Buddhism, lay people who have taken vows, if they're in a Sangha situation, will wear all white. So then there's later evolution and development in ordination vows with Mahayana Buddhism and Chinese monasteries. The Chinese in China, there became less emphasis on those 250 vows, because instead of living in the woods like you would in India, according to these 250 vows, they tended to, it was colder and they had to live in monasteries. So there was a discipline within the monastery that they submitted to. So it didn't necessarily have to have all these vows. And then when they went to Japan, so this is our lineage, you know, Buddha in India and up to China and then over to Japan. In Japan, Dogen and some others of his era decided to ordain monks with only the Bodhisattva vows. So they left behind those Vinaya vows, those 250 vows, for various reasons. And then, ironically, monks and lay people end up taking the same vows. And then in the Meiji era, so even though they would take the same vows, monks were still celibate and single. But in the Meiji era, end of the 1800s, the government said Buddhist monks can get married and eat meat. And that's a complicated political thing. Part of it, they say, was to like take some power away from the monks, because, you know, once they had to get married and have family obligations, they couldn't be quite as rambunctious and powerful. But anyway, that's a long story I could talk about. But I just wanted to show you my ordination. And so then I was ordained in 2001, and there I am with there's an under robe on that we inherited from China, and I'm holding up my folded up okesa. And then let's see, and there's me all ordained. So I'm wearing that kind of a long, you know, under robe, courtly robe, and then there's a black okesa over that, and it's over my left shoulder and tied. So let's see. So getting to, well, I'm just trying to think whether I should go into what those ordination vows mean. I think I'll just leap right into our lay vows. So in our Sangha, so I'm going to talk to you about how we do it, how I'm going to do it, because I'm your only teacher, so I get to decide. It's a little bit different from the way that my teachers did it at Dharma Rain Zen Center, where I train, and some of my Dharma sisters and brothers do it. And I will, at the very end, I will give you a little brief comparison and tell you how things differ, but just, you know, it'd be too complicated to explain how it works and then tell you how it works elsewhere at the same time. So I'm just gonna leap into how we do things here. So we have something called Jukai, which means receiving the precepts. So we have 16 bodhisattva precepts. So it actually means like the three refuges, three pure precepts, and 10 kind of the 10 grave precepts are the actual like don't kill, don't steal, da da da. And we study these every year. We spend about 8 to 10 weeks doing that. And then at the end of that, there is a Jukai ceremony. And this year it's going to be on Sunday, June 5th. And that is the ceremony where you can formally become a Buddhist. And my basic guidelines are like, you should have, you know, maybe 6 months of practice under your belt. Know that, you know, this is kind of, you know, your thing. Participate in the precepts study. And if for some reason you can't come on Tuesdays, you know, you can listen to the recordings. We have lots of recordings from past years. There's several good books on it. And clarify the intention by speaking with me, and then participate in the ceremony in person or virtually. So last year was the first time we did, well, actually the year before we did a couple people virtually as well, but they were local. They just didn't want to risk COVID. So this last year, though, we really, like, officially, there were people. We had somebody take the precepts in from Brazil, and somebody was in Alberta, Canada. A couple people flew in to do it. But, you know, we made it accessible. So for those who were, you know, at a distance and couldn't come, the only requirement was that you had somebody else present with you for the during the Zoom ceremony, so they could put the wageza over your head. So the wageza is this strip of cloth with a decorative knot at the bottom. And I do have a picture I can share here. Of when I took Jukai in 1996. I think it was kind of cute. Oops. Wrong share. All right. So that's me in 1996, all happy that I just got to take the precepts and formally become a Buddhist. So you can't see the details of the Wagesa very well there. But it has a pretty knot at the bottom that hold the two strips of cloth together. And I see a couple of them out there right now in the Zoomiverse. Let's see. Now, when I took Jukai, or received Jukai, I try to say received rather than took, because it sounds, you know, you receive it from somebody and just go up there and take it. It was a big deal to me. And like I said, again, this is not at all required. It may float your boat, it may not. But I guess for me, it felt like an affirmation of something that was very deep for me. It felt like maybe kind of upping the ante and, you know, professing publicly what my intention was. Yes, I'm a Buddhist. And in a way, maybe also then inviting people to hold me accountable for that to some extent. And also maybe a way to indicate my support for Sangha. You can show your support by participation, by membership, you know, by supporting the Zen Center with your time or your money, certainly. But it just, you know, it felt like another way of saying, yeah, I'm I'm signed up. So I know, and maybe at the end here today, some more people will speak up and talk about why they have taken the precepts. And that's often something people will discuss too when we are studying the precept later in the year. So And again, this is up to you. My own husband, John, took the precepts many, many years ago, but he confessed actually feeling a little bit of ambivalence about doing that because earlier in his life he had been confirmed as a Lutheran, and he felt a little bit like it was not, you know, wasn't compatible. But it's really up to you. Right, so we are not claiming we're perfect. We're just claiming this is our aspiration. Now, one drawback about doing this and, you know, like publicly identifying yourself as a Buddhist, if you want to do that, you could always take Yukai and keep it kind of secret from all the people you know. But if you do publicly identify yourself as a Buddhist, people may have this experience. You kind of open yourself up to the, like, if you're getting angry or something, be like, aren't you a Buddhist? So it can, you know, can be a little annoying. But for the most part, our fellow practitioners don't call us out like that because we understand, you know, taking the precepts is not a claim that we can follow them perfectly. And some people also have the question of like, well, do not kill. Does that mean I have to be a vegetarian? In our lineage, no. It's very much up to you. Vow to have these precepts as part of your life, but it is up to you to keep them and to decide what that means for you. So it's not for me to decide. I mean, you know, there's some bottom lines, like don't kill other people. Don't go break into people's homes and steal stuff. But, you know, is a certain kind of activity during work stealing from your employer or something? This can get very subtle. So also the do not abuse intoxicants, or do not become intoxicated, I think is how our precept says it. And that's not, we say polish clarity, dispel delusion. So really, it probably should be better, do not abuse intoxicants. Be mindful of your use of intoxicants. Not, you know, for some people, it is fine to have a glass of wine or a beer or whatever. You have to decide for yourself. If you recognize that that taps into addiction, then probably keeping this precept really, it does mean abstinence. So it's up to you. And we don't go into the specifics about how exactly that has to look. And then just out of just the Wagesa, which I'm going to get to the Rakusu in a moment, but the Wagesa as is a sign of having taken the precepts. And so each time we are together, so this is generally if we're meeting in the morning, like Sunday mornings, we'll sit for a couple of minutes and then we'll do the robe verse. And you might see people putting their Wagesa or their Rakusu, or if I didn't have my Okesa on, I would put my Okesa on my head. I guess that's just a sign of respect. We put it on our head, and then we say this verse. And we chant it three times, how great the robe of liberation. And basically, that is like, each time we put this garment on, we're taking our vows again. We decide again to take this on. So that's why we sit for a little bit before we do that in the morning. And if you have a Wagesa or a Rakusu, you might, it's not required, but you might typically wear that when you are with Sangha, if you come to the Zendo or if you're on Zoom, or if you are meditating by yourself or you're chanting by yourself or something, you might want to put that on during when you're doing formal practice. And so if you receive Jukai, that can be as formal as your vows get. And even without Jukai, nothing is withheld. So there's no teaching or practice that we do that is like, well, you know, only for those people who've taken Jukai or only for those people who've taken this further vow. It's open. Talking to me is open. Participating in Sangha, participating in retreats, everything. So which is to get on to another form of vowel. If you find the practice of formal Buddhist vows supportive and fruitful, and you receive Jukai, and you know you're practicing, and but you do find yourself curious about how you might deepen your practice. After a year or two of practice with the Sangha, you can talk to me about your interest in Zaikei Tokudo, or lay ordination. So Zaikei Tokudo means staying at home to accomplish the way. The monastic ordination ceremony is Shukei Tokudo, leaving home to accomplish the way. So there is a tradition, I'm not sure how far back it goes, but it's definitely in Japan as well, of lay people, you know, receiving Zaikei Tokudo. And so you stay at home, you're going to accomplish the way, you're going to practice deeply, you're going to be involved with the Sangha, but you don't go off to a monastery. So people who take this step have come to identify deeply with our lineage of Soto Zen. I'm not just Zen, but Soto Zen. And obviously, if you don't even know really what that means, then, you know, that's something that you would be discovering over time. And not just that, but our Dharma cloud lineage, our Sangha in particular. So the Dharma cloud lineage is a kind of a new designation, which is my teachers, Kyogen and Gyokuko Carlson. So their Dharma names were both Ho'un or Dharma cloud. They were both students of Roshi Jiu Kennett. So anybody who comes through Kyogen or Gyokuko, and I believe there's about like 8, 9, 10 transmitted teachers, lay and monastic, in that group now. So we call ourselves the Dharma cloud lineage. Like it's a family, right? You know, it's this kind of thing where we pass down from teacher to student. There's variation within the family, obviously, but there's certain commonalities and we share a history. So if you feel this identification, it should be rooted in personal experience of and familiarity with our lineage teachings and forms, including Zazen, retreat, Sesshin, which is, you know, residential retreat practice, which has been thrown for a bit of a loop during COVID, but is a very central practice of ours. Making and keeping vows, regular study of the precepts, ceremonies, chanting, filling practice roles such as chant leading, teacher's assistant, and care of the altars. So in other words, let's say you really groove on our particular lineage. Not just Zen, but this form of it. And not that you necessarily have to love every part of it, but you have to respect and honor it. Become familiar with it. Because there's many... So maybe let's say you don't really like chanting. That's okay. You could still theoretically take this step of vow, even if you're not thrilled about chanting. Chanting's not my favorite practice. But I do it and I include it because there are other people for whom it is a great practice. So there's a certain kind of, you can develop this sense of respect and responsibility for the tradition as a whole, and understand that it serves the Sangha beyond just your own personal preferences. So I think of priest ordination, which I have, as a responsibility to immerse myself deeply in the tradition, such that if I was dumped on a desert island with a bunch of people, like I could recreate the essence of the tradition. I could I could start a Soto Zen center. We might not, you know, have anything to read or whatever, but I could recreate it. And really, I would say that somebody who's taken Zaike Tokudo has some, not to that extent, right? But some familiarity, so they are helping to hold the tradition. Not as much of a specialist, perhaps, although they may. In our lineage, we have fully transmitted lay teachers as well as priest teachers. So many of you are familiar with Shintai, who's come to practice with us before and give Dharma talks before. And so she essentially did this, you know, Zaike Tokudo and lived her life as a lay person. But at a certain point, she was so immersed in the teachings, so immersed in the practice that my teacher empowered her as a Zen teacher. So that these kinds of vows they're not about formal authority or status or empowerment to teach independently. So like Shuke Tokudo, this is a little bit different than other religion traditions. Tokudo is an entry onto a way of practice. So when you do Shuke Tokudo and you leave home, you're entering onto a formation phase of practice. And similarly, if you did Zaike Tokudo, you are entering into practice. You are deepening your commitment as a student. A totally separate matter is our tradition of Dharma transmission. So I also have a podcast episode, episode 51, if you're curious. And what this means, it's not an infallible system, but it's better than nothing. That essentially we have, you know, you have a teacher and that teacher says, all right, you can pass this on. You are a reliable enough person. You've studied yourself. You keep the precepts decently. You know enough about this tradition to share it with other people. So in our lineage, that can happen if you're ordained as a monk or a priest, or if you are a really devoted lay practitioner. But it's a separate step. Interestingly, that also involves vows. So it's not just a like pat on the head, aren't you wonderful? It's a vow. We take the vow at that point to help carry on the lineage. So that's what we, another form of vow. But even though, for instance, this Zaike Tokudo thing that I'm talking about, which, just to be more specific, would involve, so there's already two people who have done this, although I wasn't describing it quite the same way, but Jinryu and Shoketsu have done this step. And what it essentially involves is you take the precepts again. Almost all the Buddhist ceremonies involve taking the precepts. Even the funeral ceremony, somebody steps in and takes the precepts for you. So we just do that over and over. But there's some additional vows about serving the Sangha, about, you know, living a stable life, things like that. So there's some additional vows that are about your tie to this tradition. And at that point, people then sew a rakasu and receive a Dharma name. So a rakasu, which you can see perhaps here, is also made of little squares, little stripes and squares. So this is just like a miniature version of the larger priest robe. And so just for fun, let's see, let me pull up a different picture here. I gotta stop it again. It's a little tricky. Okay, there we go. So, thanks, Jinryu. This is Jinryu's ceremony in 2018. So you can see she's wearing a rakasu, which she sewed. And as she will tell you, it is not really a very easy project at all.
Best 2 years of my life. I'll never get them back.
It's part of the discernment process. If you really, really want it, and you get to sew that. And then you can see a little bit better. I'm wearing the Okesa. So I'm wearing a brown, dark brown Okesa. And different colors mean different things too. So when you're wearing a black Okesa, you're a junior student. When you get Dharma transmission, then you wear a brownish or a yellowish one. And that's why I'm wearing like a yellow rakusu here. And then a lay teacher wears a blue Okesa. So let's see. So even though this step, this Zaike Tokudo, is not about authority and status and whatever, inevitably it may carry some of that, right? Just depending on the person. If you walk into a room and you see somebody, you know, they look kind of like they know what they're doing, and you. So when we take vows and, you know, we put on a wagisa or we put on a rakusu or we have a dharma name or something like that, we have to be aware that we need to be responsible with that, right? We do need to be a representative of the tradition and take some care with the sangha.
I would like to interject and just say one thing very briefly, because I don't want to leave my comment where it was. The first year I spent really, really, really thinking about, did I really want to do this, even though I had told Domyo that I did. And the second year, it's black on black, and that is hard. But I will say, if you're an engineer, you can do it. I can sew. And the instructions are not what you're expecting. But if you're an engineer, you can make a rakusu, I swear.
So this, I realize it might take you a little while to get your mind around what all of this means. But if you were thinking, if you've received Jukai and you're thinking, yeah, I'd like to delve more deeply into this tradition, you know, that I've listed some of those things that help you get familiar with the tradition, right? Attending retreats, going to session, volunteering for the various Sangha support roles, Zoom host and greeter and whatever. And, you know, when I call for a volunteer to lead a discussion because I'm going to be out of town, you know, stepping up for that kind of thing, checking out our ceremonies, reading the, you know, participating in the Tuesday study and the Sunday Dharma talks and stuff like that, and becoming more familiar with the teachings typical of our lineage. And then after, you know, if you've taken this step, then you know, it's pretty wide open what you do with that. So you can continue in that vein. You can, you know, really just, you know, be a hardcore Zen person. Or the very nature of Zen practice is it takes many different forms. So I just listed a few things here that I said that like an active lay ordinee may support the Sangha and lineage by contributing financially. Maybe even including the Sangha in your will or making substantial contributions if you can. Contributing time and skills for practical support, service on the board of directors, administrative support, help on the website, Zendo repairs, Zendo cleaning, bookkeeping, helping to staff the Zen Center. You know, I just left and now there's a couple people that need to tidy up the Zendo and shut down the computers and close up the building and all that kind of stuff. So in those volunteer and practice roles, you know, caring for altars, doing the chant leading or timekeeping, when we will someday do another long retreat together, there's a lot of work involved in that. Like I said, giving student talks and leading classes when requested by the teacher. And also would say, and again, this is like anybody is invited to participate in any of these ways as well. But this would be, these are ways that you can manifest this vow to be supportive of the Sangha. So an important aspect of this is participating in leadership of the Sangha. So it's very easy, and I know this because I've been like not the teacher, I've been this participant. It's very easy to complain. It's very easy to think, oh, I don't know, I'm studying that, or this hasn't been great, or there wasn't much connection between people with this thing or that thing, or... And it's like, well, what are you going to do about it? At a certain point, like, this is, you know, your Sangha. And so this is a way of stepping up and doing that. Like, if something is needed, maybe you can help offer that. If something needs to be addressed, maybe you can help do that. You know, it's definitely, we're already at the point where it's going beyond what I can do. And if this Sangha is going to remain strong over the years, that it definitely has to be something that the Sangha holds. So that's part of this, you know, Zaike Tokudo aspect. And finding ways to contribute one's extra time and energy and creativity toward enriching the Sangha. So, you know, we have people helping a book group meet once a month, and we have another group that meets once a week to discuss my podcast episodes. And, you know, for a while we had a children's program going. So, you know, you never know what you might be able to add to what we offer. So, let's see. And just a brief comparison with other lineages, and then hopefully we'll have a few minutes for questions. I can stay a little longer if you have additional questions as well. So in most Soto Zen lineages, they don't have two steps like I'm talking about. What they call Jukai is much more like what I'm talking about as Zaike Tokudo. So you generally wait longer to receive the precepts and take and receive Jukai. And you sew a rakusu and you get a Dharma name. And so it's really more like they don't have that really open, accessible Jukai like we do. That was an innovation of Roshi Kennett, which means I think I had been around like 3 months when I asked to receive the precepts. It's like, you know, if you know in your heart that that is how you want to shape your life, you want to join in that way, you want to indicate, you want to be a, you know, formally become a Buddhist, let's do it. And actually, we make the Wagesa for you. You don't have to have a sewing project. So we make that very accessible and open. And then this second step is just a longer, like you've been around a couple few years and you really want to feel called to do that. So another lineages, if you visit other Zen centers, you'll see people with rakusus and they'll say, yeah, I've taken Jukai. And if you say, yeah, I took Jukai too, here's my Wagesa, they'll be like, what is that? Just to be warned. That's fine. You can explain it. It is a garment that's worn in Japan, but it's often typically more worn in other types of Buddhism. We just kind of used it in this way. And then one other note in terms of difference is that in other, the way my teachers did it and in other Dharma cloud lineages, Zaike Tokudo, what I'm calling the Zaike Tokudo, they call it lay discipleship, which is not, I never liked the term, but it's really tough to come up with a term, formal student, I don't know. So essentially, it's the same as what I'm describing, plus you would be requesting me to be your formal teacher. So we would be beginning a formal teacher-student relationship. And over time, I have decided to separate that from Zaike Tokudo. And I'll explain why. That was an innovation. The lay discipleship was an innovation of my teachers, Kyogen and Gyokuko, because they really wanted to honor lay practice. They wanted to honor the seriousness of lay students and give them a, you know, a way to deepen their practice. Over time, though, I think it's an odd fit, because essentially what I'm beginning to see a formal student-teacher relationship is for training someone for a particular purpose. So if you were to receive monastic or priest ordination with me, I would be training you to become a priest or a minister or what teacher, right? I would be training you to share the tradition. So I would say, now you gotta do this, and you gotta do this, and you gotta read this, and you gotta do this. And you would submit to that because you want, for a purpose. Like, I'm a teacher, and you want to learn how to be a teacher, so I'm training you to be a teacher. With lay practice in general, that, like, what are, you're just trying to become yourself. I don't know what you are supposed to become. I can walk the path with you as a companion, as a friend, as an advisor, but I'm not going to, like, tell you what to do, how your practice should look, how much you should do. So it doesn't seem appropriate. It doesn't end up being a terribly meaningful thing in the same way. However, I don't want Zaike Tokudo to be limited to people who want that. I think there's a richness. There's many people in the Sangha who may want to deepen their practice and deepen their commitment to the Sangha and to this lineage and this tradition, but they don't really want a formal teacher, or they don't want me as a formal teacher. You got one option here. And really, like, if you are looking for a personal teacher in that way, you should look around. That'd be like, you know, marrying somebody because they're the only one around. it's something, you know, you have to find the right match. So I wanted to separate that out. And I probably, if people in the future do want that kind of formalization of the relationship, then that can be something separate. That can be something that's done just kind of privately, not a kind of public ceremony. But I could see that. I really appreciated my own teacher having a sense that, like, she was my teacher. But I did want to be a monk as well, so I don't know how I would have, but basically, in what I was doing was inviting her to give me the kind of feedback I wouldn't accept from other people. So there's something of value there, but I think it's important to separate that out so that this Zaike Tokudo thing is more open and available. So apparently I had a lot to say there. So it's already 12:14. So if you do need or want to just say goodbye, that you are very welcome. But I also stay around for another 10 minutes or so and take some questions. Or comments. If you want to comment, you just unmute yourself and, oh, it looks like we have somebody in the Zendo coming over to say something. I think you have to use the Doan one as the one hooked up to audio.
I was just switching the video.
No questions? Betty.
One of the things that you said, thank you for this, it was really helpful and informative. And one of the things that you said was that as you go through the steps of taking precepts and beyond, potentially, that you are committing, for lack of a better word, to the Soto Zen lineage, and particularly the Dharma Cloud lineage. Mm-hmm. So how do you know that you're doing, you know, that you're on the right path, unless you go along other paths? And then it's like, you know, then you're dead after, I mean, it's like, it's going to take forever to do
that. That is a great question. So first of all, I would say definitely in terms of receiving Jukai, we say it's joining the Sangha of the 10 quarters. So you are formally becoming a Buddhist. You might say formally becoming a Zen Buddhist, and it can mean whatever you want. If by receiving Jukai, you're saying, I love this tradition, great. But it doesn't, you know, necessarily imply that. It could mean, look, I love all kinds of Buddhism. I don't, you know, or I just like meditation or something. It can mean different things. But yeah, in terms of that, you know, do you want to get more involved or more committed? It's true. It can be helpful to have some familiarity with other ways, but I think it really depends on the person, because for me, you know, everybody makes their decisions differently. And some people have to think about it for years and try other things and mull over it. And I was just somebody like, it was just love at first sight. It was just, this has got more than I could exhaust in a lifetime. And everything that I got involved in was helpful. Every step of the way. And I never encountered anything that made me go, ugh, you know, ugh, I don't know about that. Like, I was able to just engage it as much as I wanted. I was able to question it, explore it. So I don't know. I guess as long as it feels like discovery is happening and growth is happening and you can trust it and you trust the teacher and you trust the teachings and you trust the Sangha members, I guess that's what I figure.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. Camille.
Hi. Sort of extending from Betty's question, I was wondering about the desire for the kind of feedback that you wouldn't accept from other people. That, like, related to what you'd said about you can't know what lay people are like going to, you know, to become themselves. Like when you said that, I was like I felt really disappointed because I was like, you know, and but I saw that as like, okay, well, kind of as a lay person, you have to kind of have the maturity to do it on your own in that sense. Obviously, you're not on your own and you're doing it with Sangha and so on. But like, how do those two sit together? I'm just wondering that if you want to kind of have that kind of feedback, is that just a sort of manifestation of your own? Well, how do you tell the difference if that's just a manifestation of your own ego and wanting to be told versus, yeah, I don't know if I've
explained that. That is a wonderful question. Thank you for asking that. Because the way that my teacher described it, which I think is great and I totally agree with, she said, I don't know what your next step on the path should be, but I'll know it when I see it. So there's like a recognition, you just kind of know when somebody is growing, when somebody is showing up authentically, when somebody has a, you know, thing that they don't want to look at, They have a point of resistance. They have a hardness or a reactivity. So it's almost like the details, or I would say the form. So that's what we call those who are ordained, like I was, a monk of body, a monk of form. So there's a certain way you're supposed to look, certain things you're supposed to do, a certain schedule you're supposed to keep. And then we say lay people are monks of mind. So externally, we don't know how it is going to look. Are you going to be a mom or a business person or we don't know what it's going to look like, but yet at a deeper level, it's the same, right? In the deeper level, we should be becoming more authentic, exploring our unexplored issues, things like that. So I feel like there is that guidance is possible, but it's really more of a reflection and a feedback. And that's something that we have these ideals that like superpower Zen masters would, or Buddhist masters like Dalai Lama would just be able to sit down in a room and perceive all of your issues and give you the magic words that are going to help you forward. I don't know. I've never really met anybody like that. And I frankly think that kind of person is dangerous. Because if you think you are just so incredibly wise that you can just meet a stranger and know their heart, that is tricky territory. So generally speaking, for most of us, this is something that builds up over time. So you get to know one another. You get to know one another over years. And, then it's really no different than if for some reason your friend said, all right, tell it to me like it is. You know about your friends and your family members, right? It's not a rocket science. You can be like, well, you're kind of in denial about this thing or whatever. But the difference is that in a teacher-student relationship, the student is asking for that feedback. And they've developed the trust that the teacher knows how to not abuse that and how to take their own shit out of the way, right? So they're not using that feedback to feel superior or anything like that. So if that helps. So it's one other hand, Pat.
Yeah, I'll just be quick. But what I realized is, I was thinking about what you said about John, and I did do confirmation in the Catholic Church when I was like in middle school. And it was a profound experience for me. And because I think the term we used at the time was to be a soldier of Christ, but there was a study for a couple of years and there was an understanding of values and beliefs and a commitment to go forward. And I've had the same experience with receiving Jukai. And I think where I look is that what I haven't really availed myself of is more Sanzen, but I think sometimes I have questions and I want to wrestle with those, and you're available for that. So the idea of following in Shoketsu's and Jin Ryu's paths seems bigger than I'm ready to take on. And I don't know if that's helpful for someone, because I feel like I'm in the Sangha and I want to take on responsibility and I want to do things. And there are lots of questions that I want to understand better. And thank goodness for the podcasts. But I think everybody has their own path. And for at least for the time being, my path seems to be right, except maybe there's another step in availing myself of more instruction or information. But outside of that, I kind of am not trying to go any further. And I don't So I'm just saying that.
Yeah.
One person's view.
Great. And I love, you know, speaking up and saying, you know, not for me. There was a guy at Dharmarine, he received Jukai. He was around for ages. He was around for like 25 years and he never did this step. So, you know, but it's like, we want to make that things available, right? So that's that Dharmarine, like, here's this thing which is available if it floats your boat. And just people who, you know, you said Sanzen people, that's like, I also call it Dharma interview. That's just a meeting with me. But in a way, if the whole Sangha started availing themselves of meeting with me, I wouldn't have any time. But one of the things that I'm planning to do, and then I'll wrap it up, is start what I'm going to call a practice intensives. They'll be 3 months long. So they'll be a little bit like our term student program, but more intense, so that you would be, you know, vow to promise to do a certain amount of Zazen, certain amount of study. We'd meet every other Saturday for an hour and a half. And, you know, I'd be present and you're, you know, formulate a koan for yourself for the 3 months. And my vision for it is that there would be, rather than just having to do this one-on-one with people, that it would be a chance for people to explore practice in a deeper way, but also together. So that'll be another kind of option out there for deepening practice. All right, I guess I'll leave it there. Let's see. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas. Wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. Feel free to write me with questions and stuff, and I'm going to write this stuff and put it on the website as well. So
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good one. Thanks to you at the Zendo for closing up.